The Movements is a leftist history and politics podcast. On the last episode, reform has failed and the social democratic parties of Europe have failed to stop the war. As the world war grinds the working class and peasantry like meat, a demonstration by proletarian women escalates into a new revolution. The Tsar orders a brutal suppression of the uprisings, but the soldiers of Petrograd turn their guns towards the regime and engage in pitched battles against police in the streets. The working class begins to form revolutionary committees, while the bourgeoisie abandon the Tsar, who finally abdicates. The Soviets and provisional government embark upon building a new Russia, but dual power creates tension within the revolution. With that, I bring you The Russian Revolution Part 4. Peace, bread, and land. It's hard to imagine living under a dual system of power. I don't mean multiple chambers or branches of government, but opposing governments with fundamentally different demands for the future. The circumstances that create such systems don't lend themselves to stability. At some point, one or the other is likely to fall apart. Petrograd 1917 saw the development of such a dual-power system emerging after the fall of the Tsar. The provisional government was comprised largely of capitalists, nobles, and middle-class individuals. At the same time, the rise of the Petrograd Soviet was accompanied by the spread of local Soviets throughout the Russian Empire, comprising of workers, peasants, and soldiers. The unelected provisional government promised to hold elections for a new legislative body, the Constituent Assembly, in which the bourgeoisie, middle class, and nobles were all represented along with the masses of peasants, workers, and soldiers. However, no specific date was given for when these elections would take place. In the meantime, the provisional government's executive was comprised of bourgeois individuals. After decades of struggle against the Tsar and several days of bloody street fighting to topple the monarchy, the new head of government was now a prince. To the masses of the Petrograd Soviet and other local councils rapidly forming throughout the empire, this was a disappointing and frustrating development. Many representatives of the new government held the masses in contempt, seeking liberalization of politics and the economy with little interest in the demands or the needs of the bulk of people. For many within the provisional government, their interests were diametrically opposed to that of the peasants, the majority class of Russia, who demanded ownership of noble land and reestablishment of the peasant commune way of life. As during the peasant uprisings of the previous decade, many wouldn't wait for sanction from a central government. They were seizing land, sometimes violently, from the nobles who would now be represented by the new government. For the Petrograd Soviet and the working class, the first major question was its relationship to the provisional government. Cooperation or opposition? Social reform or social revolution? Those first meetings were chaotic and full of lively debate, as one would expect. However, the formation of the Soviet was constructed largely by the socialist intelligentsia in an ad hoc manner, benefiting the opinions of the privileged socialists. With few workers present for the initial election of the executive committee, the right wing was overrepresented, creating a disconnect between the more radical rank and file, who looked to the provisional government as a rival, and the leadership, who tended to favor support for the provisional government. Feiges writes, quote, "There were no formal agendas, minutes, or procedures for decision-making in the Soviet. Every decision was arrived at through open debate, with speakers in different parts of the hall all talking at once, and the resolutions passed by general acclamation, much as at a village assembly. Because such a body was incapable of any constructive work, it soon took on a purely symbolic role, with the real decisions being made by the executive and the Socialist Party caucuses to which most of its members belonged. The workers and soldiers who had made the revolution had in effect lost their political voice to the socialist intelligentsia, which claimed to speak in their name. Unquote. This was the context in which Vladimir Lenin returned to Russia on April 3, 1917. The Bolshevik revolutionary had lived in exile abroad for the past decade, having fled in the aftermath of the failed 1905 revolution. Lenin had been watching events closely and dispatched his writings to the Bolsheviks from afar. Opinion on major political questions varied among the Bolsheviks. Joseph Stalin and Lev Kamenev had arrived in Petrograd weeks prior. They organized the party in support of the provisional government, even as it prolonged the war via the policy of revolutionary defensism. Stalin even supported a reunion with the Mensheviks proposed by their leader within the Soviet, Irakli Tsereteli. Tsereteli had adopted a bourgeois-friendly position, praising the working class for avoiding a proletarian revolution and understanding that, quote, "the time has not yet come," unquote. Mieville quotes further, quote, "You understand that a bourgeois revolution is taking place," he continued. "The power is in the hands of the bourgeoisie. You transferred this power to the bourgeoisie, but at the same time, you have stood guard over the newly gained freedom. The provisional government must have full executive power insofar as this power strengthens the revolution." Unquote. Upon his first meeting with Kamenev since the closing of the Russian border, Lenin began castigating the old comrade almost immediately upon sitting. Quote, "What's this you're writing in Pravda? We saw several issues and really swore at you." Unquote. The train arrived in Petrograd shortly after 11 p.m. Accounts of the moment record a crowd of workers and soldiers wielding banners and red flags, cheering as Lenin stepped off the train. Despite his minority position on several key issues within the revolutionary movement, the crowd numbered in the thousands, surprising and disorienting the Bolshevik radical. Immediately, he set out to meet with the Soviet. His welcome there was less enthusiastic. Mieville quotes Chairman Nikolai Chikidze, quote, "Comrade Lenin, in the name of the Petrograd Soviet and of the whole revolution, we welcome you to Russia," said Chikidze. "But we think," he continued anxiously, "the principal task of the revolutionary democracy is the defense of the revolution against attacks from without or within. We consider this end to require not disunity, but the closing of democratic ranks. We hope you will pursue these objectives with us." Unquote. Ignoring the Soviet delegation, Lenin paused to survey his surroundings, finally addressing instead the crowd of rank-and-file workers and soldiers. He declared the worldwide socialist revolution imminent and again reiterated the demand that the war be turned into a European civil war of the proletariat against their country's bourgeoisie. He invoked the name of German revolutionary Karl Liebknecht, praising him for his principled opposition in the face of persecution by the leaders of German social democracy. Nikolai Sukhanov later recalled, quote, "I will never forget that thunder-like speech which startled and amazed not only me, a heretic, but all the true believers." Unquote. Earlier that day, the All-Russian Conference of Soviets from throughout the empire had closed its inaugural session. With support from the Bolshevik caucus, it adopted moderate positions agreeable to the provisional government, such as the cessation of anti-war propaganda on the front lines. Talks to reunite with the Mensheviks were to begin the next day. Simultaneously, Lenin continued his shocking attacks and presented a document by the name of The Tasks of the Proletariat in the Present Revolution. He laid out 10 points articulating positions on the major political questions of the time. Mieville writes, quote, "Among its 10 points was the wholesale rejection of limited support for the provisional government and the no opposition pledge of the Bolshevik Petersburg Committee. Lenin repudiated without the slightest concession revolutionary defensism, continuing to advocate fraternization at the front. He demanded the confiscation of landlord estates and the nationalization of the land, to be disposed of by peasant Soviets, a single national bank under the Soviets' control, and the abolition of the police, army, and bureaucracy. For now, he said, the order of the day was to explain the imperative of a struggle to take power from the government and to replace any parliamentary republic with a republic of Soviets. Unquote. The April Theses was met with condemnation and ridicule from most members of the Soviet. Within his party, response was mixed and varied, with Alexandra Kollontai being the sole high-profile Bolshevik in full support from the beginning. Pravda published Lenin's position alongside criticism and rebuttal. Kamenev and others advocated appealing to the provisional government, arguing that by making demands they knew wouldn't be met, they could expose the bourgeois government. Lenin argued that they should bypass the provisional government altogether and instead engage in patient explanation to convince the rest of the Soviet delegates, as well as the masses themselves, that the provisional government was hostile to their interests. Lenin commanded great respect from the Russian Marxist movement, yet the April Theses were far more radical than anything being considered by any of the socialist parties of the Soviet. However, they were closer to the demands of the masses than the Soviet leaders realized. While Lenin's position was still in the minority, the masses grew more radical with time passing. Stephen A. Smith describes Lenin's rare political acumen when advocating unpopular positions. Quote, Lenin's politics were rooted in Marxist theory, yet he had a profound grasp of the workings of power and a capacity to take tough and unpopular decisions and to make sharp changes to policy. His detestation of liberalism and parliamentarism, his conviction that the provisional government could not deliver what the people wanted, his implacable opposition to the imperialist war, and his appreciation of the potential of Soviets oriented him well to a political situation in which society was polarizing along loosely class lines. Alongside cadres who had endured years of hardship, tens of thousands of workers, soldiers, and sailors flooded into the party after February. Knowing little of Marx, but seeing in the Bolsheviks the most implacable defenders of the interests of the common people. Unquote. The bourgeoisie, the middle class, the workers, the peasants, the soldiers, all had their own reasons to oppose the Tsar. But with abdication, class divisions and political differences began to reemerge. With a bourgeois government nominally in power, centrist nobles and middle class parties resolved to join the government with reservations. The right-of-center constitutional monarchists, known as the Octoberists, were represented in the provisional government holding the Ministry of War and Navy. Center-left bourgeois liberals were represented by the Constitutional Democrat Party. The cadets, as they were known, held the ministries of foreign affairs, transport, education, and agriculture. The rest of the posts were held mostly by the socialist revolutionaries, along with a few odd ministries controlled by the Mensheviks, liberals, and non-party ministers. At this point in time, the right wing, landlords and nobles, monarchists, and Russian nationalists were a disorganized mess and isolated. Conservative generals were unhappy about Order No. 1, the codification of the soldiers' committees, and the implementation of democracy within military units. However, the inclusion of the bourgeoisie in the government, as well as the policy of revolutionary defensism, offered temporary assurance that the political revolution would stop short of social revolution. Moreover, the provisional government played a hard line against independence movements. These generals would offer uneasy allegiance for the time being. The aforementioned nationalist movements throughout the empire began to agitate and organize openly and more boldly since the end of the autocracy. Decades of Russification had repressed nationalism among the non-Russian ethnicities of the empire, but now they were increasingly demanding autonomy both culturally and politically. The provisional government resolved to maintain the borders of the empire as much as possible while providing individual rights rather than national rights. To the bourgeois liberal, nationalism was a symptom of discontent at the harsh repression of the Tsarist system. Civil and religious equality was their solution. While the SRs and Mensheviks of the provisional government had campaigned for autonomy in the past, they were now in support of a government that opposed granting political autonomy. Some SR leaders spoke of Russia as a new Switzerland, decentralized republics and cantons, but part of a unified state. The responses of the different nationalist movements would make entire episodes of their own. Some, such as the Azeris, Belarusians, and Lithuanians, saw themselves as more of a common ethnicity than a nation. Many Jews were excited at the prospect of civil and religious protections. The Armenians looked to Russia for protection from the Turks. Ukraine saw growing nationalist and socialist movements, though it's arguable that their nationalism was more concerned with local interests and self-defense than a wider nationalist project. In many of these areas, the German army occupied and supported nationalist movements, hoping to create a political buffer and anti-Russian alliance. With Poland largely under German occupation, the provisional government symbolically declared support for full independence. In the case of Ukraine and Finland, they negotiated but refused to make any meaningful concessions. This obstinance would only strengthen the nationalist sentiments in both. While placating the Russian nationalists, the national question would only become more paramount in the coming months and years. Throughout the empire, local landlords and nobles were in retreat as the peasants, increasingly confident that the autocracy was finished, acted with greater boldness to seize land. In the aftermath of Nicholas's abdication, thousands of resolutions were adopted by peasant committees calling for greater democratization and reorganization of power towards local self-rule. Institutions of the previous systems of government were swept away as land captains and village police were abolished in favor of committees elected by peasants themselves. The provisional government sought to take control of the committees, but saw little success. The pro-government propaganda campaigns were no match for the influence of radicalized peasant soldiers returning from the front. Some committees even declared themselves as local Soviets. Peasants gradually refused to pay rents, illegally grazed livestock on noble land, stole materials, and escalated into land seizures and violence. Phygis writes, quote, "A band of peasants, led by some former soldiers, forced their way into the manor house of Prince Vivi Saburo and hacked him to death with axes and knives. It was a bloody retribution for the role his son had played as the local land captain in 1906 when 12 peasant rebels had been hanged in the village before their screaming wives and children." Unquote. The government, under pressure from the landlords and nobles, refused to recognize the land seizures without compensation. As the year passed by, conflict between the provisional government and peasants over grain prices and food supply would create more tension between the central authority, which demanded the sale of grain at a fixed price, and the peasants, who responded by hoarding and turning grain into alcohol. Whether Tsar, provisional government, or later the Bolshevik government, the peasant question would remain a challenge and a source of major conflict. With these problems in the background and the tensions between the masses and the bourgeoisie simmering, the provisional government faced its first major crisis over a message written by Cadet Foreign Minister Pavel Milyukov, indicating his commitment to continuing an offensive war. Stephen Smith writes, quote, "In a note to the Allies that was made public on April 20th, Milyukov made clear his support for the secret treaties that promised Russia the Black Sea Straits as the fruits of victory. The Milyukov note had been sent to the imperialist powers of the Allies days earlier with the intent of reassuring the British, French, and others of Russia's commitment to the war. Mass demonstrations erupted immediately, led by soldiers. As the demonstrations demanded the removal of the 10 bourgeois ministers from government, they clashed with counter-revolutionaries in the streets, leaving several dead. A battalion under the control of Fedor Lind rebelled and appealed to the Soviet to endorse mutiny and to arrest the bourgeois ministers. Though the Soviet instead ordered Lind to stand down, tens of thousands of others continued to demonstrate. Right-wing General Lavr Kornilov asked to use force to crush the demonstrations, but experienced resistance from his men. Mieville writes, quote, Kornilov was a career soldier of Tartar and Cossack stock, aggressive, dashing, unimaginative, brutal, brave. He had the unenviable task of reestablishing military discipline in Petrograd. As if to prove to him the scale of the commission, the soldiers now snubbed his order. Instead, they followed the Soviets' command to stand down. Kornilov was a hothead, but not a fool. He swallowed back his fury and contempt and avoided confrontation by rescinding his own instruction. Unquote. The Soviets sought to avoid a confrontation with the provisional government and ordered a de-escalation in the streets, objecting to armed demonstrations calling for the overthrow of the provisional government. Despite Soviet pleas, for days the demonstrations continued with revolutionary fervor. However, this situation was beyond the patient explanation recommended by Lenin, who criticized demands for overthrowing the provisional government as adventurous. Lenin explained that their position still lacked popular support, and the call for overthrow was premature. Hostility to the provisional government was growing, but no overthrow should occur until the Soviet adopted the demand. During April 24th to 29th, the Bolsheviks held their Congress in Petrograd, during which Lenin successfully argued against the immediate seizure of power. Quoting Lenin, quote, "The Petersburg Committee moved a wee bit too far to the left. To move a wee bit left at the moment of action was inept. It occurred because of imperfections in our organization. Were there mistakes? Yes, there were. Only those who don't act don't make mistakes. But to organize well, that is a difficult task." Unquote. In the end, the Bolsheviks voted to adopt the positions of all power to the Soviets and an opposition to revolutionary defensism. Mieville writes, quote, "Considering the horror which had greeted his proposals barely 3 weeks earlier, the shift was remarkable. Lenin's stock was rising in his party, and fast." Unquote. Mieville continues describing the weak position of the provisional government during this time. Quote, "On the 26th, the provisional government issued a frank, emotional appeal. It admitted, as the April days had shown, that it was not in control in Russia. It invited representatives of those creative forces of the country, which until then had not taken a direct and immediate part to join the administration. This was a direct plea to the Soviet for formal collaboration. It wavered, riven by debates over how to respond." Unquote. Prince Lvov asked members of the Soviet Executive Committee to join the government. After initial resistance from the right wing of the bourgeois government and the left wing of the Soviets, the latter voted to accept Lvov's proposal. Smith writes, quote, "On April 29th, the Minister of War, Guchkov, resigned without bothering to consult his colleagues, and 3 days later, Milyukov was also forced to resign. On the 6th of May, moderate socialists assumed 6 places in a coalition government against 8 occupied by bourgeois representatives, giving them limited influence but full responsibility for government policy." Unquote. Prince Lvov remained the head of the new government, but all other ministers were replaced. Most noteworthy was the new Minister of War, Alexander Kerensky. Socialist revolutionary leader Viktor Chernov also joined the new government, much to the chagrin of the left wing of the party. The left SRs had not yet come into their own as a separate entity from the right wing SRs, but divisions between the right and left wing socialists was becoming more entrenched than ever before. Julius Martov returned to Russia to lead the internationalist wing of the Mensheviks, condemning collaboration with the provisional government. He condemned the ultimate stupidity of the socialists who joined the government without securing a promise to end the war. The Menshevik internationalists, the anti-war wing of the party, were a small faction within the larger party and were soundly defeated during the conference in early May. Martov was not the only anti-war Marxist to return at this critical moment. The day before the new government took power, Leon Trotsky returned from a decade in exile. Trotsky had been living in New York City on the eve of the revolution, frequenting Yonah Schimmel's conniciery on 137 East Houston Street. And yes, I am shamelessly hoping for free conniches by mentioning this fact. Trotsky entered the Tauride Palace to applause and warm praise from the Soviet. He was remembered as the key leader of the St. Petersburg Soviet in 1905. Distrusted and respected, Menshevik and Bolshevik alike admired his brilliance despite his arrogance and tendency to offend. At this point, he was aligned with neither party and represented a small group of independent Marxists. The audience wondered what he would say. Trotsky began his address. Mieville writes, quote, "Sugar sprinkled. Trotsky then dosed with bitter medicine. I cannot conceal," he said, "that I disagree with much that is going on here." Sharply, with growing confidence, he condemned the entry of the socialists into the government, the fallacies of dual power. He recited to the gathering three revolutionary articles of faith. Do not trust the bourgeoisie. Control the leaders. Rely only on your own force. What was needed, what he called for in the silent room, was not a dual, but a single power. That of workers and soldiers' deputies. Our next move, he said, will be to transfer the whole power into the hands of the Soviets. The formula could have been Lenin's. When he left the hall, Trotsky was applauded far more tepidly than when he had come in. Bolshevik ears, though, had pricked up at his words. Unquote. Lenin was so impressed by his speech that he offered Trotsky's group a seat on the editorial board of Pravda if they would merge with the Bolsheviks, an offer which Trotsky declined for the time being. Throughout the country, peasant violence and worker militancy increased, a disorganized mess of class war, righteous militancy, but also petty crime and brutal violence. In one example, Jewish women, an oppressed and politically organized demographic, led the struggle in Smolensk province for an 8-hour workday, a 50-cent wage increase, weekends, and paid holidays. Workers would wheelbarrow abusive managers into the river. In other examples, the lack of central authority allowed racist violence, such as the brutal murder of a Chinese woman whose body was further mutilated after death. In some cases, servants of wealthy nobles were murdered during plunders of the wealthy estates. The wealthy and middle classes were increasingly inclined to support the right wing as the Cadet Party began to move in a counter-revolutionary direction of defending property rights and landlords. The Bolsheviks struggled to maintain discipline among their supporters who were itching for a confrontation with the provisional government. The 10,000-strong 1st Machine Gun Regiment was housed in the Vyborg district, a militantly working-class neighborhood and a bastion of Bolshevik support. They refused to remain in their barracks until the removal of the bourgeois government, standing ready to take arms against it whenever the moment came. The soldiers of Kronstadt, an island naval outpost outside of Petrograd, declared themselves an independent Soviet that refused to recognize the provisional government. The Kronstadt Soviet was controlled by Bolsheviks, anarchists, and SRs and loomed ready to take arms as well, much to Lenin's distress. Again, party discipline demanded that no direct confrontation be undertaken. Negotiations ensued, and the Kronstadt Soviet agreed to recognize the provisional government later in the month. In early June, the government attempted to expel anarchists from an occupied building, but the Kronstadt sailors descended to defend their comrades, prompting another near-bloody confrontation. Again, the Bolsheviks under Lenin's leadership called for patience while rivals accused them of organizing a takeover, a charge that historian Orlando Figes finds no evidence in support of. May saw the provisional government move from crisis to crisis. Despite the entrance of the new socialist ministers into the government continued to ignore the increasingly anti-war mood of the masses. Smith writes, quote, "Having entered the government to hasten the conclusion of peace, they found themselves at once involved in preparations for a new military offensive that was being championed by Kerensky, the new Minister of War. Kerensky's enthusiasm for a new offensive was motivated by a desire to see Russia honor her treaty obligations to the Allies and by the belief that a truly revolutionary army could assist in the creation of a comity of democratic nations once victory was achieved. General Alexeyev, perceived to be too cautious, was replaced as commander-in-chief by General Brusilov. For their part, the Allies had few illusions about the fighting capacity of the Russian army, but they were keen to keep Germany tied down on the Eastern Front. Meanwhile, soldiers were becoming radicalized thanks to SR and Bolshevik agitators, so it was not at all clear whether morale would hold up long enough for an offensive to be carried out. Kerensky, with a crew cut and wearing military fatigues, tirelessly toward the front, calling on divisions to prove to the world that they were fighting not for autocratic adventurers, but for a free Russian Republic. Speaking tours were Kerensky's specialty, trudging confidently through the front lines, exhausting himself. Some soldiers welcomed the minister, with early reports of Kerensky being carried by soldiers, showered with flowers and hurrahs. On occasion, Kerensky wore a sling over his right arm, despite no record of an injury ever occurring. Some soldiers joked that he'd injured himself, shaking too many hands. Despite Kerensky's theatrics, desertion rates remained high, with more and more peasant soldiers returning home to join in the uprisings and seizures of noble land. In truth, Kerensky avoided soldiers unlikely to support his message of one more offensive in order to achieve peace. Some soldiers were more likely to shower him with bullets than flowers. Mieville writes, quote, "He was kept away from those where to attempt it would have been to invite injury or worse. When he did speak, he soon left, and when the brief narcotic of his sermons ebbed, the soldiers were still stuck scant yards from enemy lines in freezing filth, in the sights of machine guns. His best speeches notwithstanding, at several stops Kerensky was heckled." Unquote. The Bolsheviks continued to gain ground for their ardently anti-war position, despite their small numbers. Within the Socialist Revolutionary Party, tension was growing between the right and left wing. During the latter half of May, Viktor Chernov came under attack during the party conference. Several influential left SRs condemned the party leadership for mutilating the party platform, with several moderate positions on land seizures and war. Among the left faction was Maria Spiridonova, a recently released political prisoner incarcerated for the assassination of a provincial landlord and police official. While assassination was a common tactic utilized by the populist SRs, Maria had gained particular popularity during her 12 years in prison. She had been elected mayor of a Siberian town near her former prison camp and now stood for election to the Socialist Revolutionary Central Committee. The left SRs only won a single seat on the committee, but they had received a significant minority of support from the rank and file, achieving 40% support on some votes during the conference. Secretly, the left SRs started to form coordinating committees, setting the stage for the eventual split between the right socialist revolutionaries and the left socialist revolutionaries. As the movement against the provisional government grew, a demonstration was organized for June 10th. Soviet leaders vehemently opposed the planned action and voted to ban the demonstration for 3 days, prompting the Bolshevik leadership to cancel late the night before. Tens of thousands of workers and soldiers had to be talked down by Bolshevik activists. The Soviet instead called for a June 18th demonstration supporting revolutionary unity, ambiguously referencing cooperation with the provisional government. 400,000 demonstrators appeared on the streets, though most of them appearing under a different slogan: "All power to the Soviets." Maxim Gorky, veteran of the Narodnik populist movement, condemned the most recent events as an Asiatic revolution, destroying Russia. He reacted with frustration towards the anti-government sentiment of the June 18th demonstrations. Quote, "Only the Bolsheviks marched. I despise and hate them more and more. They are truly Russian idiots. Most of the slogans demanded down with the 10 bourgeois ministers, but there are only 8 of them. Although I am a pacifist, I welcome the coming offensive in the hope that it may at least bring some organization to the country, which is becoming incorrigibly lazy and disorganized. Unquote. Early American historiography of the Russian Revolution would echo much of this characterization. Like Gorky, American political scientists and some of the early historians of the Soviet Union evaluated the violence and disorder of Russia as based in ethnicity rather than as a result of material conditions typical to social revolution throughout history. Figes writes, quote, "It was his belief that all human progress and civilization derive from the West, and that all barbarism derive from the East. Socially, historically, and geographically, Russia was caught between Europe and Asia. The Petrine state tradition and the Russian intelligentsia were both westernizing influences. The peasantry were Asiatic, while the working class was in between, derived as it was from the peasantry, yet capable of being civilized under the intelligentsia's guidance. The Russian Revolution, which Gorky realized in 1917, came essentially from the peasant depths, was an easternizing and barbaric force." Unquote. The writer admitted that the war unleashed the anger and brutality of the Russian people, and yet he, along with the moderate socialists, thought the Russian people would find salvation in the same war. Alexander Kerensky came to represent a civic patriotism meant to unite the country. Historian Orlando Figes refers to the cult of Kerensky, an image of a Russian Napoleon that had developed since the beginning of the revolution. Narodnik military cadet Leonid Kanagaiser, who would later commit one of several assassinations by populace in the following year, wrote this poem, quote, "And if, swirling with pain, I fall in the same of Mother Russia and find myself in some deserted field, shot through the chest on the ground, then at the gates of heaven in my dying and joyous dreams, I will remember Russia, liberty, Kerensky on a white horse." Unquote. In speeches to soldiers, Kerensky spoke of civic duty and advocated unity over class division. The soldiers' committees and other democratic measures of Order No. 1 were an extension of class division, an obstacle to restoring military discipline. Kerensky argued that previously the soldiers had fought for an autocratic regime. Now they should fulfill their duty as they had before, but instead for the cause of freedom. "Or is it," he said, "that the free Russian state is in fact a state of rebellious slaves?" Figes writes, quote, "There was an uproar in the hall. For the soldiers, in their own self-image, had indeed been slaves before Order No. 1, and Kerensky now seemed to be asking whether they were worth their freedom as citizens if they were not prepared to go to war. The phrase rebellious slaves echoed around the country for weeks. It did much to turn the soldiers against Kerensky. But for the patriotic and the propertied, it was just the sort of appeal to discipline and duty that they had long been calling for. And they now rallied behind Kerensky and the idea of an offensive at the front. It was almost as if they sensed that only a victory could save them now." Unquote. The Liberal Cadet Party now openly called for a new offensive, causing a plunge in their popular support. Now they looked away from the masses and towards the propertied middle classes by appealing to patriotism over class, for defense of the fatherland. New Commander-in-Chief General Brusilov, who had angered the more conservative generals by advocating cooperation with the soldiers' committees, found himself unable to sell soldiers on the need for an offensive, avoiding the word for fear of violence from mutinous soldiers. Figes describes one incident in which Brusilov denounced the Germans for savagely destroying a French winery, eliciting the comment, quote, "You want to spill our blood so that you can drink champagne," unquote. To Brusilov's credit, unlike the Russian Napoleon, he was willing to address hostile crowds of soldiers and offered one Bolshevik-supporting soldier the opportunity to speak. Figes writes, quote, The soldier, a young red-bearded peasant, stood next to Brusilov, leant on his rifle with both arms, and looking askance at the commander, delivered a speech in which he claimed the soldiers had had enough of fighting, and that for 3 long years the Russian people had spilled their blood for the imperialist and capitalist classes, and that if the general wanted to go on fighting for champagne, then let him go and spill his own blood. The troops all cheered. Brusilov was lost for words and began to leave, and as he did so, the soldier read out the declaration of the soldiers' committee calling for the conclusion of an immediate peace. The commander-in-chief of the Russian army had been upstaged by a simple soldier. Unquote. Brusilov warned Kerensky of the mutinies, increasing desertions, soldiers crossing over to the German lines with white flags, even reporting that one unit of 23,000 had declared it would only answer to Lenin. Kerensky ignored the reports and the advice of Brusilov. The offensive began on June 16, 1917, with a 2-day artillery barrage. On June 18, the offensive began with initial success as the Germans abandoned their positions. On day 3, however, the offensive stalled and the Germans counterattacked. The front line collapsed almost immediately as soldiers refused to move forward and began to abandon their own positions. As before, some soldiers shot their own officers. Others went on drinking binges while looting alcohol stores. In some cases, soldiers attacked Jews or raped women. A total collapse of discipline was occurring, and mayhem was the result. By the end of the offensive, hundreds of thousands had mutinied or deserted. Rumors that the government would abandon Petrograd to the Germans emerged, and Prince Lvov's notes would confirm that this was seriously considered as early as July. A curious trend emerged among some members of the propertied classes in response to the possibility of German occupation. Vigis writes, quote, "Many of the patriotic middle classes prayed that they were true. It was a dinner party commonplace that only the Kaiser could restore order." Unquote. On the day that the offensive began to stall, the government called upon the soldiers of Petrograd to move to the front. Since the start of the revolution, no unit of the Petrograd garrison had moved to the front, the Soviets having negotiated a concession from the provisional government that the soldiers remain. In reality, the government could not have ordered these units to the front, as they'd retained independence and allegiance to the revolution above all. 250,000 of soldiers, many Bolshevik supporters or otherwise radical, could easily end the provisional government. The foreign minister, Tereshenko, however, confided to a British ambassador that the offensive would provide the cover needed to transfer radical troops to the front and restore military discipline. Kerensky himself repeatedly referenced restoring order in the rear as an objective of the offensive. When the news hit the 1st Machine Gun Regiment, 10,000 soldiers armed with 1,000 machine guns, that they were to be transferred to the front lines, it confirmed all their worst fears. Removing the radical soldiers and eventually restoring total control of the Petrograd garrison would leave the Soviets without leverage. The votes, resolutions, elections, none would matter if the Soviets lost the garrison. The unelected provisional government was moving to destroy the revolution. Within a day, the regiment voted to ignore the order and overthrow the government if it continued to order the garrison to the front. Other units followed suit with enthusiastic support from the Bolshevik military organization. The Bolshevik Central Committee, on the other hand, urged restraint. Lenin himself argued for patience until the party had won a majority in the Soviet. Vigis quotes Lenin, quote, "One wrong move on our part can wreck everything. If we were now able to seize power, it is naive to think that we would be able to hold it. Even in the Soviets of both capitals, not to speak now of the others, we are an insignificant minority. This is a basic fact, and it determines the behavior of our party. Events should not be anticipated. Time is on our side." Unquote. No doubt, the ruthless slaughter that ended the Paris Commune 5 decades earlier lingered in the minds of many. As Lenin fell ill at the end of the month, his control of the party was lost and the Bolshevik and anarchist militants moved forward. On July 2nd, a send-off concert for soldiers assigned to the front instead became an anti-government demonstration. Attendees debated into the late hours whether to move forward with an armed insurrection against the provisional government. They ultimately elected a provisional revolutionary committee, which began to reach out to other units. July 3rd, the streets were flooded with worker and soldier, similar to the number of the February days, but nearly absent the middle class and wealthy individuals. Many of the demonstrators were armed. Vehicles were overturned, checkpoints set up, and in one instance, bored soldiers fired machine guns into the wealthy neighborhoods. The crowd was leaderless with no clear direction, though they eventually moved closer to the Tsar-eyed palace. The crowds exchanged gunfire with reactionaries and right-wingers in the streets. The Soviet itself debated how to respond to the crisis. The leadership had opposed the demonstration, and though the crowd had called for all power to the Soviets, some demonstrators were calling for the arrest of the current collaborationist Soviet leaders. The Soviet was, in fact, debating whether to form coalition with the provisional government. As the day ended, nothing had been accomplished. No leaders had been arrested, though many believed it to be so. That night, the Bolshevik Central Committee debated their response. Up to this point, they'd cautioned restraint. Lenin was being summoned back from Finland, where he had been recovering from illness. Pravda had been set to publish a front-page article by Zinoviev and Kamenev urging calm, but the committee decided last minute to call for an organized demonstration and continue the uprising. Despite the fantasy concocted by anti-communist historians like Richard Pipes, there is almost no evidence that the July days were a planned Bolshevik plot. The best evidence to support this thesis lies in the memoirs of Nikolai Sukhanov, in which he recounts a story told to him by Lunacharsky on July 7th. Sukhanov himself doubted several aspects to the story, as they contradicted the actual events over the previous days. For example, he acknowledged that the Bolsheviks could have taken power on several occasions but didn't. Later historians looking at the records of the period instead described chaos and confusion, with the Bolshevik Central Committee largely improvising. Upon his return, Lenin himself was struck with indecision and doubt. The Bolshevik leadership waited and debated with no decisive action, while the workers marching with the local Bolshevik organizations in the streets awaited orders to seize power. None came. 20,000 Kronstadt sailors arrived in Petrograd, armed and backed by medical teams. They marched to Lenin's residence with marching bands playing the International and asked for instructions. Figes writes, quote, "Lenin was uncharacteristically hesitant, did not want to speak, and when he was finally persuaded to make an appearance on the balcony, gave an ambiguous speech lasting no more than a few seconds, in which he expressed his confidence in the coming of Soviet power, but left the sailors without orders on how to bring it about. He did not even make it clear if he wanted the crowd to continue the demonstrations, and according to those who were with him at the time, did not even know himself." Unquote. The disappointed soldiers departed for the Tsar-eyed Palace, linking up with the other demonstrators along the way. But on their march, they encountered gunfire. Cossacks and trainee officers on rooftops unloaded their weapons onto the demonstrations below. The demonstrators returned fire wildly, though some threw their arms and fled. Dozens of demonstrators were killed. The mood remained dark after the battle ended, with chaos spreading as demonstrators began firing randomly, looting shops, and beating the well-dressed. The 50,000 armed demonstrators arrived at the Tsar-eyed Palace, where they awaited orders to storm. The palace itself was barely guarded, no more than a few dozen defenders. Hours passed, and some of the most hardcore entered the building and confronted SR leader Viktor Chernov. After being searched for weapons and condemned for not taking power from the provisional government, Chernov was seized and thrown into a car. Leon Trotsky rushed to intercept the soldiers, shoving his way through the crowd to reach the Kronstadt sailors and their hostage. Figes writes, quote, The Kronstadters all knew the figure of Trotsky and awaited for his instructions. Had the Bolsheviks planned for the seizure of power, this was surely the moment to urge the sailors to go on to the storming of the Tauride Palace, the arrest of the Soviet leaders, and the proclamation of a socialist government. Trotsky called for Chernov to be released. "Comrade Kronstadters, pride and glory of the Russian Revolution," he began in his clear metallic voice. "You've come to declare your will and to show the Soviet that the working class no longer wants to see the bourgeoisie in power. But why hurt your own cause by petty acts of violence against casual individuals? Citizen Chernov, you are free," declared Comrade Trotsky, opening the door and motioning him to get out. Chernov was half dead and plainly did not understand what was happening to him. He had to be helped out of the car and led like a frail old man back into the Tauride Palace. A critical moment had passed, one of the most famous in the history of the revolution, and with it also passed the initiative for a seizure of power. Unquote. At 6 p.m. that day, the 176th Regiment arrived with the intent of defending the revolution, but had no clue who was to deliver orders. Lunacharsky allegedly told Sukhanov that they had arrived in order to arrest the Soviet leaders, but in reality the soldiers were completely lost. Upon arrival, an officer entered the building asking for orders. They were posted around the palace with orders to guard it from the crowds. Any attempt to seize the building would now be met by an entire regiment of trained soldiers. That night, the crowds began to disperse. A few more isolated attempts to seize power faltered due to lack of leadership and direction. More and more loyalist and right-wing military units arrived. As they approached, Soviet leaders rejoiced, though some weren't so enthusiastic. Julius Martov described it as a classic scene from the start of the counter-revolution. The siege was over. Almost immediately, the reaction targeted the Bolsheviks. Right-wing newspapers began to publish stories accusing Lenin of being a German agent, including allegations of demonstrators being paid to hold Bolshevik signs with funding from German intelligence. Paid protesters. The rumors had the effect of turning some army units against the Bolsheviks, including the units now arriving at the Tauride Palace. The reactionary soldiers attacked the Pravda printing house, arresting the workers, destroying equipment, and demanding the traitor Vladimir Lenin. Fygis describes actual German support for the Bolsheviks as rather minimal, with no evidence for any German influence on Bolshevik policy. Nonetheless, the press went wild with accusations that the Bolshevik party had colluded with the Germans to coordinate their seizure of power with the German counteroffensive. Many papers included an anti-Semitic angle, calling attention to the existence of Jews within the leadership of the Bolshevik party, Leon Trotsky and Lev Kamenev most prominent among them. The dubious nature of the claims didn't deter Alexander Kerensky from seizing on the opportunity to discredit a political enemy. Mieville writes, quote, "Kerensky quickly distanced himself from the release, but this was coy. On the 4th, he had already written from the front to Lvov that it was necessary to hasten the publication of the information in our hands. The Byzantine details of the calumny were based on the say-so of one Lieutenant Yermolenko and a merchant, Z. Burstein. The latter alleged that a German spy network in Stockholm, headed by the Marxist theoretician turned German patriot Parvis, maintained Bolshevik connections. Yermolenko, for his part, claimed to have been told of Lenin's role by the German general staff, while he, Yermolenko, was a prisoner of war whom those Germans, according possibly to a convoluted chain of mistaken identity, had attempted to recruit." Unquote. The danger to the left was swift. The far right roamed the streets attacking Bolshevik sympathizers, even murdering an activist, distributing newspapers. In at least one instance, women workers attacked and wounded a Bolshevik woman after hearing a Menshevik declare that the Bolsheviks were German spies. The Central Committee reached out to the Soviet and agreed to order their supporters to surrender the streets and buildings they still occupied in exchange for no retribution. The following day, the Provisional Government made their move. Mieville writes, quote, At dawn the next day, General Polovstev directed to the Kashesinskaya mansion and to the Peter and Paul fortress a huge attack force, 8 armored cars. The Petrogradsky Regiment, sailors, cadets, and the Aviation Academy were backed by terrifying heavy artillery. At 7 p.m., the commander gave those within the mansion an hour to surrender. The firepower arrayed against them was awesomely disproportionate. When the government soldiers entered to arrest them, they found 7 members hurriedly burning party files. Soon thereafter, even the soldiers who had made it to the Peter and Paul fortress agreed, miserably, to surrender. Unquote. The government issued orders to arrest Lenin, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Lunacharsky, and Kollontai for organizing the unrest, and irked Trotsky demanded that he be added to the list. The authorities hunted for Bolsheviks all over town. The SRs and Mensheviks in the provisional government supported the persecution, even targeting the left SR faction in the arrests. On July 8th, Prince Lvov resigned and invited Alexander Kerensky to replace him, hoping to prevent a collapse of the government. Upon taking power, Kerensky appointed the right-wing General Lavr Kornilov as commander of the Southwestern Front at the urging of Boris Savinkov, former member of the SR Battle Organization, the Narodnik assassins who had previously targeted Tsarist officials. Since then, he had become infatuated with war and joined the French army, returning in April 1917 to serve Kerensky's war ministry. The revolutionary terrorist had now become an advocate of harsh discipline on deserting soldiers. Kerensky had already approved of live fire on fleeing soldiers, which would now be codified into the right to execute soldiers, satisfying Kornilov's wishes. Kerensky met with other generals in order to assess the military situation and continue the war effort. General Denikin accused the revolution of causing Russia's military collapse, and the other generals joined him in demanding the overturn of Order No. 1, effectively calling for the end of dual power. By July 18th, Kerensky ceded more ground to the generals, appointing Kornilov the commander-in-chief. Throughout the empire, right-wing militants began to reassert themselves. Anti-Semitic tirades were common on the streets, as pogromists felt newly empowered to call for violence against Jews. Trotsky, Kollontai, Kamenev, and Lunacharsky were arrested. Lenin and Zinoviev fled Petrograd, hiding from the authorities. The two of them spent days inside a barn, exposed to mosquitoes and rain. Lenin did his best to acclimate and continued his writing, waiting for an opportunity to escape further. One day, 2 armed individuals approached their lodging, prompting the revolutionaries to hide in a haystack. Awaiting arrest, Lenin whispered to Zinoviev, quote, "The only thing left to do now is to die an honorable death." The men approached, but passed by instead. They continued towards the water and began to shoot ducks. Lenin and Zinoviev breathed sighs of relief and continued to wait. The Movements is a leftist history and politics podcast. Transcripts may be requested for accessibility reasons by emailing movementspod@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Movements Pod and support the show by donating at patreon.com/movementspod. On occasion, Kerensky wore a sling over his right arm, despite no record of an injury ever occurring. Some soldiers joked that he'd injured himself, shaking too many hands. Kerensky avoided soldiers unlikely to support his message of one more offensive in order to achieve peace. Some soldiers were more likely to shower him with bullets than flowers.